Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 561. I'm going to be performing with the Oddball Fest this Friday in Wantagh, New York. Did I say that right? Do you say Wantagh? Wantagh. Should I know that if I'm performing there? Maybe. But we're going to be at the Nikon at Jones Beach Theater with a slew of other comedians. Some really good comics that you may have heard of, like Louis C.K., Sarah Silverman, Bill Burr, Attell, Hannibal, Jeff Ross, Brody Stevens will be there. Go to oddballfest.com to get tickets. Also, Saturday is the Series 8 premiere of Doctor Who with Peter Capaldi. It is pronounced Capaldi, by the way, because I asked him when we did the event last week in New York. We screened the show for the Doctor Who World Tour, and it was fantastic. He's going to be a very good doctor. Of course, I always miss when a doctor goes away, but when a new doctor comes in, there's another space in my heart. Like the hands on a clock. So that is Saturday. It is premiering at 8 p.m. Doctor Who, and then we are on with the Little Who after show at 11, 10 Central. So please watch that, and let us celebrate the new season of Doctor Who together. This episode is Matthew Weiner, who created a show called Mad Men, and also wrote on a show called The Sopranos. And he's an incredibly interesting guy, obviously super smart. And if you really want to learn how to craft something, an idea, Matt is a good guy to listen to, because the man has an incredible eye for detail, and he's super, super, super smart. So he has a movie out right now, which actually, depending on when you listen to this, it opens August 22nd, but it stars Owen Wilson, Zach Galifianakis, Amy Poehler. The film's called Are You Here? He wrote and directed it, and, he's already, Mad Men still even hasn't even played out yet. There's still a handful more episodes to air next year, and Matt's already doing other stuff, so I'm very pleased to hear this. He was wonderful to talk to. Here's the Nerds Podcast number 561 with Matt Weiner. Also, you can see us bowl against him on All-Star Celebrity Bowling. We bowled against the Mad Men cast a while back on our YouTube channel, so watch Matt bowl, and now listen to him talk. Start the thing.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Yeah, this lot's almost 100 years old. There's, if you started ripping the walls open, you'd find some shit.
You're saying, I think it was Desilu.
Yeah, our stage was the original I Love Lucy stage.
That's cool. That's good. That's a good vibe.
Especially when we made like 45 shart jokes today. I think we really brought up the... I think we're really paying tribute to the fine TV legacy of Desilu Productions.
We had, you can't, you always want to be on a stage that has some kind of good luck to it.
Yeah.
But when I was at Paramount, we were on a show, and they go, they shot Citizen Kane on the stage. And I was like, and what happened? How did we get here? There's so much crap that goes through it. But, Renmar.
Yes.
Which is right around the corner
on
here. Genji did Weeds there, and we wanted to go there. They have the highest success record. It's very small.
Renmar does?
Oh, my God. Everything, even Seinfeld was there the first year. There are so many famous shows that went through there.
Renmar's on Cahuenga, right? Am I right about that?
Yeah. The one across from Technicolor.
That's awesome. This one has...
If you saw the list of people who had shot there, it's like when you go to a Broadway theater, in the back they tell you all the plays that were in it, and some of them are good and some are bad. Everything there made it. And just superstition-wise, I kind of wanted to be there.
Well, that's so funny that because... when I don't know if you guys are still shooting Mad Men in the same place, but...
We're done.
Well, you're done.
Yeah.
The one that you shot.
Yes. We shot there for 7 years.
But what's interesting about those studios, that studio, is that I've been there to shoot other things, and all of the offices look like the original Sterling Cooper offices.
Part of the reason we picked the studio.
You guys just cleaned them up.
Yeah.
That's all you just cleaned up the
studios. No. We redid everything, but we did like the idea that we could shoot anywhere in that building because it's from the period. And there's a lot of furniture that was left behind. They just, when 76, Union 76, the oil company ran it and owned it. It was their building. And then they bought all the houses next door and turned it into a studio. So the tower is still there and everything. But they just left all the furniture behind, and it's really valuable. There's all this incredible mid-century furniture, and they've redone some of it. We shot on the top floor, which if you – they gutted it finally. They renovated for different reasons. But we fixed a lot of the stuff up. But the top floor of it, it was an Oklahoma oil company. And the entire top floor was two offices, and in the center it was open to the world. And I was like, "What was this? A helipad?" And they're like, "No, it was a barbecue."
Oh shit!
It was a barbecue in the top of the middle of the building.
Which is, I think they realized at that time was not a good idea.
I don't know. They didn't want to be too far from home. They're like Oklahoma oil guys.
So they just opened the roof.
It was just like a big open pit, and like it's like a for a party. It was.
I guess that's
nice.
What you do if you have Oklahoma oil money.
You're just like, I want a skyscraper, but I want to make sure we got a barbecue.
I will not go to Los Angeles exactly. without a goddamn indoor barbecue pit. They're like, okay. That runs on oil. They just ran it on oil.
Yeah, it's incredible.
But that was I love that lot's really interesting. They fixed it up over the years too.
Oh, it's very. I mean, you know, it has its charm. Unfortunately, there were escalators that went in between the floors, and they closed them up because they couldn't repair them at a certain point. So the hallways are really long and scary, like the longest hallways you've ever seen. Like yeah. to the point, like. I remember there's a door right across the hall from us, but our hallway is literally 600 or 700 feet long from the elevator.
Jesus Christ.
And I was there late at night one night, and there was a knock on the door, and I opened up the door, and there was nobody there. And
no.
I was like, because they had gone right across the hall. It's the only place you could go that was fast enough, but I just thought there was no one else there. It was a great horror movie moment.
That is a really creepy – that
oh
building
God.
Is really creepy.
There's some ghosts in there, but everything – I've had a great vibe there. And the desk that I have that I wrote the entire series at was in the office when I came in.
Oh, that's yeah. – did you keep it?
I'm still there. So we'll see. I'm not going to say whether I'm going to take it.
So this is the big announcement. We're going to announce Mad Mentions, the after show for Mad. That's so funny. I saw you at a party, and I was like, hey, are we going to do a Mad Men after show? And you go, no. I was like, I know. I'm kidding.
I know they want to do it. Look, you know, they're fun, but there's enough conversation about the show.
We don't need to do it. It was I think two after shows is enough that any one person should do.
Yes. And it's I don't know. I've resisted as much of that as I can, you know, to sort of just keep it within its world. Webisodes, all that other stuff. We just try to keep it pure on some level.
I hadn't watched I came onto Mad Men in the second season. Because I feel like I'm always behind on everything. Because there's
I am too. You know, someone was talking by the third season, someone goes, I just watched it. And I was like, really? And in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, like, I am that person. Everyone is telling me, you got to watch. And you kind of want it to die down. I didn't watch Seinfeld till like season 4. I didn't watch Friends until even later.
Have you watched Mad Men? It's a good show.
I have. I started watching right at the
pilot.
You're
an early adopter.
Yeah. Yeah.
But because I remember seeing Ham around the because he's kind of a comedy nerd. So he would hang out at the comedy shows. And I knew him sort of casually. And I hadn't watched the show yet. And at that time, that was, you know, you guys were sort of doing for that section of cable kind of what the early, I don't know if this, I hope you take this as a compliment, but like when Dream On came on HBO and it was like, oh, they're making like really good shows on what was otherwise a channel that just showed movies.
No, I mean, it was a hard thing to even explain to people where we were. That we were not A&E,
right?
That AMC, I think, had already couldn't show like the same movies as Turner. They were some kind of lawsuit or something, mm-hmm. So they didn't even have like the super classic movies that they had. They had just switched to an ad format, which upset a lot of people. So there was a lot of stuff that was sort of like mixed into zero. And you know, I told Charlie Collier, I was like, the success of the show, if people start saying AMC instead of A&E, then we've really, really nailed it. And they still do say A&E sometimes. But no, I mean, I take that as a compliment. I think that the first thing I definitely got, you know, you get into these – HBO had sports and they had, you know, let's face it, HBO was really built on real sex.
Mm-hmm. You could always get that titillation like – oh, this is real people having sex. And you're like, real people having sex is horrifying.
No. Yeah. You're like, swingers? Oh, they look like – that's not what I wanted.
Naked hippies in the woods.
I know. I actually think that reality TV was a way to sort of get out of that, to get the best version of that. That they started casting these really, really, starting with Survivor maybe,
yeah.
That you'd get these really, really attractive people. And they can't really learn lines. They can't really act a lot of times, these people, but you could put them in a situation.
Real world.
And, yeah, real, exactly. Real, and all of a sudden you're getting like that, whatever that is that we love to see about them. And that was not the case on Real Sex. Not the case at all. You're like, this is not, every one of these things was a, you know, every time you'd like, wow, that's interesting. You're like, I don't want to do that.
Okay, I just put a pacifier in this butthole. I don't need to see this.
Though, you know, I, yeah, we like to swing and you're like, you do? What about the other people? Oh, they're not going to do it.
we like to swing. That's all I need to hear. I'm gonna watch something else. And we put a barbecue pit in the middle. Oh, no. It's the oil guy.
But no, the, yeah, I mean, I think it did, it, that was the intention. I think that they had, from some business reason, they had maximized, you know, the growth of the company, and that they realized original programming was a way to start attracting advertisers and get attention. And they made one pilot. I don't think they even knew what had happened. You know, they made, HBO made, you know, 11, 12, networks made 30, 40, yeah. Sometimes, you know, talking about hundreds of millions of dollars being into this pilot process. And they made one. And they said, we'll see if we try it, you know, and it, all of a sudden we had an audience on the channel.
Well, so what? Well,
and it coincided with a lot of technological stuff went on. Like right away, it was the first place I worked where I couldn't tell people what the number was of the channel.
Oh, right.
And it was just starting to become this interface that whether, even if it wasn't TiVo-based or anything else like that, where people could like search for the show.
Right.
And that was like a big transition for the audience that I don't think people realize. It was a big transition to go from like, oh, you're on HBO, there was one HBO, you know, you're on HBO, you're on channel 7, or you're on, what is it, 254, but right. It's like 253 on some systems, and so
it was HBO West, and then
exactly,
HBO
exactly,
East,
so that kind of a thing where now people don't even keep track of that, they just know, like, you know, they've got their basic cable the package, and then there's like 900 VOD channels, and then they get to HBO's.
Well, I started watching in the I went back and watched the first season when the second season, right before the second season started, and was immediately blown, like, holy shit. I mean, because I think part of it was you go in, again, not knowing what AMC was at that time, thinking right. American movie classics, and then seeing this show that's not only just gorgeous, but so well written. And then the next time I saw Ham, like I had a totally different. I was like, oh my god, your show is fucking amazing! Like I was.
Did you lie to him the first time though and say it was like, hey, it's really good? And then the second time you hadn't seen.
No. I was honest with.
I've been caught with that too. I'm like, hey, really nice to meet you. I'm a big fan. And then all of a sudden you're like, I met that guy and I hadn't seen it and I lied. I would have gushed.
Well, you're waiting for someone to be like, oh really? What's your favorite episode? The one where you overcome the thing.
The funny thing about the show, that's very complimentary. That's a very nice thing to say. But it is a thing. The show in particular was so peculiar that I could really tell if people had seen it, because it's really, for whatever reason or other, very, very different, and still is very different than a lot of other things. I just still don't know what the genre is. I still don't know a lot of things about it. But I always look at it and I feel like, you know, it's not for everybody, but I think that it was, especially at that time, so incredibly different. And I praise them still, AMC, for taking a risk to do something different. And that was their business strategy. And a lot of the show in the first few years, the business stories are about AMC and Lionsgate and them sort of dealing with it and how to deal with things.
Yeah. I mean, because not only did the show blow up as a show, but also, I mean, you could see how within a couple of seasons, how much like Don Draper aesthetic had permeated our culture.
It's so weird. And it took me a while to actually notice that.
I'm wearing
that.
A fucking skinny tie right now.
that was
not happening before like 07.
The best thing is I had, well, I always figured, I always said like, we will know the show is a success if next Halloween someone is walking down Santa Monica Boulevard dressed as Joan. Mm-hmm. That was my only thing. I was like, that will measure the success. but there is a certain point where it starts coming back to you and you're like, well, what's going on? And I went into Brooks Brothers to get a suit and somehow it came out what I did. And I had all my kids with me, all my boys with me. And there was like, that's 9 times out of 10 where they ask you what you did, where you do, mm-hmm. what is it that you do? And I told him and he goes, you know what? He shook my hand. He goes, I have to thank you. Before that show came on, I don't think – I've worked here for 11 years. I never had a guy under 30 come in and buy a tie. I was like, okay.
They had to blow it out the
– Exactly. Like who's going to – casual Friday, all that sort of stuff.
But there was also this – you know, I don't know if I mean, obviously, I'm sure people know this, but there was a subtle comedic undertone of the first season, which was pregnant women smoking. And yeah. people drink, and like every time you'd see it, it'd be like, Jesus Christ. You know? And there was just something inherently funny about about capturing that slice of what the culture was like.
The sort of blissful ignorance about things.
Exactly. I mean,
yeah, there was a line in one of the early episodes where Francine, who's Betty's pregnant friend, they're at the derby party and she's like having her fourth cocktail and she goes, I don't know what it is. I am so thirsty.
Super pregnant.
Yeah. You're like, well, you know, maybe you shouldn't have had that fifth mint julep.
But it's also a period.
But I mean, there's a sort of, I mean, I didn't want to do too much of like, look how smart we are or anything. The weird thing to me is there's a lot of stuff that was really true that we were capturing about the way things were that people would sort of argue about. Like people smoking inside, depending on their age, or, you know, seatbelts and car carriers and kid, you know, all this sort of stuff that's part of our culture now that you look back on it and you're, there's a few winky ones, but I basically try to make the show not wink at things. I think the one that I hear the most about is in the second season, they go on a picnic and they get up and they just leave all their trash. And it was actually something I was raised with and it was hard to explain to people, you know, that it's just the way it was. And it was hard to even explain to the actors, like, don't look back. Just leave the trash there. The world is a big place. We would just throw stuff out the window. I mean, I can't even explain it to you. I don't remember. My grandfather was a little bit more... I would not say eco-conscious because he drove a Buick Electra 225, which was a giant car. But he did have a bag filled with trash. Mm-hmm. And you would put the trash in there and he would empty it out. But he would be mad at you for throwing stuff out. But I mean, tickets for littering. He literally had to like throw a sofa on the side of the road to get it.
Was it a culture of, do you think we were a culture of ignorance or just like a culture of denial? Like not looking back, like, no, yeah, it's fine. Someone will get it.
I actually think that people didn't see it. I think it's one of these things like when you move and you put the paintings against the wall, the pictures against the wall and the boxes, and then you live there for 2 years and you don't see it. People just didn't see how much garbage there was. When we try to recreate street scenes a lot, the amount of trash we have to put on in New York is cleaner than it was. I can't even explain it to you. Watch a movie from the decayed part of New York, like from the mid-70s, right. Like the Seven Ups or... Mm-hmm. French Connection, like in that era, and you will just see like rotting. You'll see graffiti on things that is like so thick you can't even tell what they are. You will see just trash piling up everywhere, and this is a lot of it's before garbage bags, so it's like pails. And mm-hmm. I just think it was I think it accumulated all at once is what happened. I think it was going on for a while in ignorance. That's a big place. And then it accumulated all at once, and all of a sudden everyone's like, well, why does it have to be this way? And of course, you know, the crying Indian was like was an ad that was a big, do you remember the Indian
of
with the tear?
Of course I do. So yeah, the can lands right at his feet.
Yeah, that ironized Cody. That's sort of like a big moment where but part of what I was interested in when I started the show is that all these things started in the early 60s, right when the show started, this sort of consciousness about it. And I think in 1960 or maybe a little bit before or after that, Rachel Carson wrote The Silent Spring, which was the first sort of eco book that wasn't just celebrating nature, was saying that we had destroyed everything and that we were poisoning the water. And it became, as you got into the 70s, it became an ecology movement, green movement, whatever. You know, now it's a big business, which I think is what saved us.
I wonder if part of the reason the Native American was crying because we took all his fucking land.
He had many reasons.
God
standing
damn it,
on the highway.
This is what you're doing?
He's actually crying about the fact that there's a highway going through with a bunch of thunderbirds driving on it.
It used to be his front yard. That was a beautiful unobstructed view of the landscape. But why? So what was it about AMC? Coming off The Sopranos, I would imagine you could probably pretty much, you probably had some options, I would imagine.
I think I would have had some options. I never went that far. I definitely, my agents told me that I would have some options, as they do. I wanted the Mad Men pilot script was something that I had written that had gotten me my job on The Sopranos, and I wanted to make the show. And the entire time I was at The Sopranos, I tried to get HBO interested in it through David Chase. Mm-hmm. And there was no, I don't even know when they read it or didn't. And this is not just criticism. It's just, I never had that job of having to pick stuff, but they didn't. And so I just kept pushing it and pushing it and pushing it, and nobody else really wanted to do it. And AMC, Christina Wayne, and you know, and also material gets sort of poisoned at a certain point the longer it's around. Like, right. If everybody reads it and it doesn't happen.
Oh, that Batman script's floating around.
Yeah, and I mean, it was a period piece. I didn't think it was, like, losing its relevance in any way. But when it got me my job on The Sopranos, a lot of people read it, and I had a lot of meetings, and they would say things to me like, this is a great piece of writing, which was very complimentary. They got me in for the meeting, but what do you really want to do? We're never going to make this show. Oh, do you watch TV? Whatever. And so AMC expressing interest in it. It wasn't like a bidding war or anything. And in fact, they made the pilot by themselves. The way it usually works in TV is that the channel finds a studio to produce right. it, and they couldn't get anyone to do it. So they wow. paid for it themselves, and then afterwards got Lionsgate to, which is a big risk. And Lionsgate then came in and bought the show.
I think it was, I actually think it worked out. Obviously it worked out for the best, but I'm having a difficult time picturing it on HBO, because on HBO you wouldn't really have any content boundaries. And I think what's
I always wonder about that.
Yeah, because obviously there would be nudity, and you'd see, like, but you know,
I assumed that I wouldn't have any content boundaries when I wrote it. I did think it was going to be on HBO, I found that immediately that it was really helpful. And as the 60s have progressed in the show, I have pushed a little bit more with language and things like that, because I think it's part of the story. Mm-hmm. But I always I don't know, shooting sex scenes and the all of the things that are, I like the moment before and the moment after dramatically. And we have pushed it a little bit. And there are certain things that were very, very, you know, Basic Cable has certain rules, but AMC actually has more stringent rules than FX. So we are TV mature, not TV 14. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the language is controlled. You can't say, you know, Jesus Christ unless Jesus Christ is actually there. You can mm-hmm. say Jesus and you can say Christ.
Right.
And there's more things that I could go into. They sent us an email with a bunch of words that we couldn't use, four words that we couldn't use.
What are they?
And, they weren't the only ones, it turned out, by the way. But it's what you expect it would be. It was pretty, pretty clear. It was just like, fuck. It wasn't shit. It was like, fuck, cunt, the N-word, mm-hmm. and I think there was one other sex-related word. But they weren't the only words. We started hearing about them all the time. But in the end, I kind of found that working around all of that, there's plenty of swearing going on. Then yeah. Those guys had all been in the military. But there wasn't as much swearing in social situations, especially in the workplace. And so I felt that the sort of like artificiality of it like helped me challenge me to write in a, you know, people are saying fuck you to each other all the time in a right. million different ways. And so, but Pete does say fuck you in the pilot to Don, and we just dipped it.
Well, yeah, because you definitely want to be able to use words that are indicative of the time and not, you know, and of course their challenge is like, yeah, but audiences are contemporary, even though this is a period
piece. You know what their challenge is that they actually have regulations
yeah.
and standards and practices about what can be said and what can't be said, and you try and adhere to them, the specifics of which are often embarrassing. And, you know, at a certain point, you know, we're like, you can show someone smoking a joint, but they can't inhale it. And then they've got Breaking Bad on the other channel, you know, where they're actually cooking meth on the other stage. And I was like, and you know, and they were using me against Vince for sex and Vince against me for drugs. And you sort of had this thing where like, we're going to have to find a kind of medium in here that is realistic. We will not, you know, overdo it. And we will suggest things. And I think most of what happens, because the sex is very important in the show, and it's a big part of the storytelling. Don's a carnal guy. And I like the sort of implied nature of it. And I know that you can watch it with kids, and if they don't fall asleep, they will have no idea what's going on.
Is he a textbook narcissist? Is that his problem?
Don?
Think? Yeah.
No. I don't know how to analyze what it is. I think at this point, enough experts have told me what they think is wrong with him. He's what you call a very successful person. Mm-hmm. And and I think he probably suffers from attachment disorder, which is not narcissism. Betty's more of a narcissist.
Okay.
Don is a person who actually is observing humanity a little bit, has very low self-esteem, medicates with sex and with alcohol and and medication when he can get his hands on it. And I think his functioning is, he's an empathic person who has feelings for other people, but he's also kind of mystified by attachment itself.
Oh, you're right. He couldn't possibly be a narcissist because he really cared for the woman whose husband's identity that he took over.
I mean, a narcissism is like a very complicated word for me because now it just means egotism, but when...
No, it's like Betty. No, like no empathy for anyone else.
I think the Betty's thing is like Betty is so filled with feelings that her. I look at narcissism as like her thing is that no one is as good as her, and she's always got these expectations of like behavior, and she dwells on it, and she's a little bit of a borderline personality to get more specific. But you know, when you're writing characters, I don't really judge them.
Sure, you can't.
I don't question their behavior even down to what's good and bad. I try to make it situational, and I think that that's part of the problem.
And you have to help...
Is that our behavior is situational.
And you have to help, in the writing, help justify... I feel like you're always dropping clues for, here are possible explanations for why these people are the way that they are.
I think there's a cause and effect, and I think you carry your problems around you, and I think that a lot of the things that we see as their like bad behavior are symptoms.
Right.
Not the diseases, you
and know? And this was definitely this was also a period of time where it was even though there is a little bit of therapy in the show, but it was a time when people didn't talk about that stuff and they
medicated. Men didn't men did not talk about it. There's a huge wave of psychoanalysis in the 50s for Americans. It's bigger here than almost anywhere in the world. Freud was like, I don't like what they're doing there with what I wanted to do. He in the 30s, you know, when he visited America, he was like, this is not what I meant. It was so in style in the 50s into the 60s, and then it became a huge part of the culture. But it was, Don said it was not polite to talk about yourself. And for men especially, like, you don't see the word depressed. We didn't use the word depressed in the show because people didn't use it. Men especially, I'm depressed. They would just say, you know, depression was like an economic term.
Mm-hmm.
They'd be like, I'm blue, or, you know... Not drunk enough. The emotional complexity for men is like, unless you're, you know, a writer, it's just not, it's not addressed. And that's why I think not being on HBO and having those constraints to help me construct something that was a little bit more subtle.
Let me ask you a really annoying question, which is, do you think that there are shades of Don and Tony Soprano that are cut from the same cloth? But obviously because Tony was in a different – he was in a different cultural period that he was able to start trying to deal with the kind of weird anxiety, depression, emptiness that he felt.
I think it is embarrassing for someone to have a psychological problem. Tony has like panic attacks, and Don has had a couple of panic attacks. I don't know. I mean – any comparison between those two characters is like completely flattering to me. They were actually created around the same – not created, but I had not seen The Sopranos when I started writing the pilot. And then I saw it and I was like, well, Don's like Tony, but he doesn't kill people. So I thought –
He kills him with charm.
And he works on a cigarette account. But Tony is probably has a little bit more self-pity. He's just a modern person. And Tony is so much more powerful than Don.
Yeah.
I mean, I always loved this dichotomy on The Sopranos. This is what held the whole show for me together, you know, before I worked there, which is that this guy could kill anybody he wanted, sleep with anybody he wanted, do, you know, all these different things. And when he got home, he had absolutely no power.
Right.
And I think Don is more removed. I mean, when I was selling the pilot, they kept saying to me, where's his Melfi? Who's he going to talk to? And I was like, they didn't talk to anybody.
Right.
That's who these guys are. They're
he
not talking
to his wife.
They didn't talk. Yeah. He didn't tell his wife who his parents were. Yeah. That's just not part of it. You just sort of sucked it up and live with it. But there is a psychic cost. And I think that as you start to write a character, you know, now 92 hours, you start looking for reasons and trying to construct, you know, the substance of who they are. But I discovered a lot of that. I just used to go with the behavior of what I thought he would do. And he's sort of basically based on an American character type from literature and, it's, you know, and from reality. I had read these biographies of like Sam Walton and Lee Iacocca and a lot of the people who had shaped the 20th century. And they had these like rural poverty backgrounds, or Lee Iacocca's case, urban poverty, that they had just completely obscured. This shameful, you know, poverty is very shameful for the people in it. You just don't get over it. And they had sort of lied about who they were and then got there. And maybe they would get to a point where they would talk about how poor they were when they were kids, but and how they were self-made, but they would read those Horatio Alger books and be affected by them, but they are not Horatio Alger characters. They got a lot darker past to them. And I just felt I had this experience at a job where there was a guy who worked there with us who kept talking about Harvard. And finally, and this is before the internet was quite so readily available. It was there, but nobody really knew how to use it or had the time to sign on. And someone found out that this guy had not gone to Harvard.
Oh.
Yeah, and there was like a big sort of casual showdown between a couple of people where somebody sort of dropped it, and he didn't really react. He like sort of blushed, and he's like, I don't know that I ever said I did go, which was not true. We talked about it all the time. And then finally, everyone just went on. Nobody gave a shit.
Right.
And I was like, this is America. It does. I mean, good for him for knowing that dropping that name would be he lived in fear, I guess, that he'd be caught, but it didn't matter in the end. And that was kind of a lesson for me about how we are about success. It kind of doesn't matter if you fit the form. And Don looks like that person. He's aspired to become that guy that he read about in magazines. He's good looking, so that helped him, but he really is a constructed person. And, you know, just to get back to the psychology thing, there's this incredible case study written about Marilyn Monroe. And when I was reading it, it felt the most like the personality of Don Draper of anything that I've read. Yeah.
Just the difference between Norma Jean and Marilyn.
Yeah, just the, will anyone ever really know me now that I've invented this person?
And do they want to be known?
They kind of do at a certain point when they get there. They want to be known. They want to be loved, but they can't really get that close. And at the same time, they don't want to be known. Absolutely. Like, do you want people to know?
Because it must be really scary to think that everyone loves this other identity.
Exactly.
And also the idea that, you know, I find that we place so much of our self-esteem into other things, but how powerful to place your self-esteem into a completely other being that is like, it's interesting you say that you feel like he's removed, because it's almost like an actor being able to take on a character, but not, and like those traits are in there somewhere.
I have had this, and I mean, I like to put roles for actors that I think are within the physical realm of their experience. You know, I don't like people putting on accents, and I've sort of, you get a kind of a vibe about people, especially the longer you work with them, and try and write for that. But, you know, I had someone, you know, in an audition, I said, can you just use more of yourself? And it was someone I'd known for a long time, and he said, Matt, like, the reason I'm an actor is I don't know what that is.
Right.
It's like an incredible skill to have that mutability. And at the same time, there's a lack of substance that the rest of us is associated with. I know for writers, and there's plenty of personality for writers, but there's definitely a lot of observation going on, a lot of imitative behavior, a lot of, you know, just seeing how other people behave when they're natural.
Mm-hmm.
And what you see is a lot of contradictions, a lot of like self-interest, a lot of, you know, the things that most comedy comes from, you know, like, you know what I hate? I hate people who drink so much. Give me another beer. Like something that simple. You will hear that all the time. I remember talking about being on a sitcom and saying that, and someone was saying that this joke was a cliche. And it was a joke like that, like, I want another beer. And, you know, I hate people who drink. And the guy's like having his fifth drink. And someone walks in and he said, I have this on my phone. I have recorded this. And it's a conversation with his agent. And he said, and the agent says something like, I was talking to Arnold Schwarzenegger this morning. And I was saying, people who name drop are assholes. And there it was. We're like, I was like, there, you know,
it's,
you can't argue with that. It happens constantly.
It's a thing that happens.
Yeah.
I'm kind of interested in the idea that as characters, Tony Soprano and Don Draper both have seemingly what, you know, every man's dream would be. They got all the money and they can fuck anybody they want,
right,
and they're powerful and they got
and Tony
and
can kill people.
He can kill people.
But he can't kill everybody.
He can't kill everybody, but he can kill a lot of people.
But it was a realization as the show went on. You know, David was really great about this when Bobby Bach, spoiler alert, but when Tony's brother-in-law what got in his way, you're like, and embarrassed him during the Monopoly game, you're like, he can't kill his brother-in-law. He can't. He can't do it. Tony's like, he's just, it's just, that's not possible.
But these guys have all these things that you think that they're trying to fill this hole with, and they're still incredibly unhappy. Like, they have everything, yeah. And they still...
I know. You don't want it to be... I know. I always thought that about Big Love. I was, like, watching this, and I said, I guess this is supposed to suggest that a man who's married to five different women is going to be unhappy.
Right.
You know what I mean? And you're like, I guess that they're sort of like this, these, there's the negative in it. I don't want it to be a moral statement of like, hey, guess what? You can't have it all. But I think that Don and, you know, Tony is a bit of a miserable anyway. And what I start to realize is that maybe the guys who have that unhappiness, that's whether it's on Pete Campbell's side or Don's side, that is the thing that makes them, that gets them to the place where they can do so much, is because they are so incredibly unsatisfied and because they are lacking in so many other qualities that they just push for it.
Well, yeah. And I don't think it's, I mean, all the things that they have, I don't think those are neutral things. Like,
right.
It doesn't, you know, the money and the sex.
I was mystified when the show came on that he was such a, that people wanted to be like him. I mean, we kept saying it on the showing that he wasn't like that. He's like that in public.
They wanted to have the things that he has. I don't think anyone wants to be like, because it's basically there is this like unfillable void that no matter how much he throws in,
right,
is never going to make him feel even. He never feels even. And
right,
so he never feels stable fully. And he's constantly trying. He's constantly searching for
that. I think people
that
identify with that. I think it's actually a comfort to say, oh, that guy looks like that and has all that, and he still feels that way. I think a lot of the audience that watches the show feels that way.
Well, not only that, but I think they also like feeling that in the Mad Men universe, to everyone else, he's perfect,
right?
And he has a perfect life and a perfect sort of a family,
right?
But that people watching, it kind of makes them feel like nobody's perfect. Like that guy, like he's one of them. He's the most fucked up character on the show, and it's like everyone else, he seems perfect. So
there
it makes them feel good.
There is a superiority complex for the audience. It's been interesting to me to learn all of these things because I approach it all from the inside. I'm telling a story. There's not a lot of philosophy in it. I work with a bunch of very talented writers to like create a story that is entertaining, that you're not going to know what it is. Their motivations for things, and the problems are super small, right? They're like, somebody got more than I did, or why can't I get that and everybody else can, or what, you know,
right,
what I mean? They're like, there's very small sort of stories. I mean, Don has a particularly dramatic story, but it's still, the confrontations are on a tiny scale. You know, the climax of the last season, the great moment is he comes home and he missed going for Thanksgiving with his family. We know that it's emotionally devastating, but I mean, he'll see them, you know? So with stakes that are familiar to people that don't involve, you know, I got to kill somebody by 5 o'clock or I'm going to get murdered or whatever, which not that I don't like those kind of stories, but when the stakes are like that, I started sort of understanding like what the audience liked and didn't like. And it was always a surprise to me. You know, I was mystified by, you know, I'm not saying Betty Draper is a great mother, but, you know, I started having my own theories about people were very hard on Betty Draper. And I was like, she is being treated very badly by her husband. She's a really devoted wife and she's faithful and she is raising his kids and he is not a good husband.
Right.
And no one ever took her side. And he's not a great dad, by the way, you know.
Right.
So, and I was always like, well, I wonder if she was less attractive, if they would feel sorry for her. I mean, I always wondered what it was. And now we've had 92 episodes to sort of explore that. But there is a superiority thing that there's sometimes it's satisfying to say, like, I know more than her, or I know where the story's going, or I know whatever else it is. And I just try not to think about it and approach it from the other side. I'm going to tell you a story. It's not the style of every story because you don't know what's going to happen. And you got to give yourself over to that. And sometimes it means being maybe made to feel a little foolish if you don't see something coming. And for me, I love that. It's what I love about Soprano. You know, you're like, oh my God, of course that's what happened. It was inevitable, but I never saw that coming.
Well, there are also subconscious mechanisms at play in your brain, and you're expressing things that you probably don't realize that you're expressing. And when they all come out,
yeah,
then you're like, oh shit, that actually connects to this. And you may think it's an accident, but it's probably your brain was squeezing something out.
There is a lot of stuff. There is a lot of stuff like that where you're like, I cannot believe this was obviously on my mind.
What? And can you think of any?
It's mostly embarrassing. You know, I can tell you that, you know, just from last season alone, I didn't know that Don and Megan's marriage was over. I didn't know. I thought, well, you know, they got a long distance situation and they are married and he's being faithful and he's being sober. And yeah, he lied to her about not having a job, but he's going to hang in there. And I didn't know that it was going as badly, even after the threesome. And finally, one of the writers was like, you know, they had like elected someone to let me know that it was over.
So no, it can't be.
Well, you know what? Honestly, he could, you know, look, some people are raised by people in a marriage like that. It could go on forever, but that it had exhausted its, you know, lifespan was, you know, I didn't know that, you know, I don't know. There's stuff that's on my mind sometimes about, you know, the cool thing is that you can take an idea that you can't put into words and put it in the show. And even though there's a lot of conversation and people writing about it, that's the thing that's the most satisfying when you talk about your subconscious is that we've done episodes that are about a feeling. And I don't know that people who are watching it in serial and like, well, how is this advancing the story for the season? They may not grasp onto it. But then after it passes, it sticks with you and you go back and look at it and you sort of see, okay, Don and Sylvia locked in a hotel room together. This is about a man who's powerless and about a married woman who's being ignored by her husband. And she's having the fantasy of living in a harem and he's having the fantasy of having complete control over another person. And at a certain point, she says, I don't want to have an affair anymore. I had a dream that, and I realized I was ashamed of cheating on my husband and it's over. And Don says, please, you know? And you're like, I think what I'm saying is Don could take it or leave her until she said no.
Right.
That was not like a, you know, calculated thing. It was just like, what's the next step? What does he need right now? What does she need right now? And then you're in and you get the next episode and he's obsessed with her. Because he can't let go.
Yeah, because it's
and
because
she said no.
She said no to him, and then now it's that he's not familiar with that territory.
It's not even real.
So it activates. It must activate all the stuff that's really down deep of like, oh, I have low self esteem. I'm not good enough. What did I like?
We did the next episode when they all took speed, and you saw that he had been interested in that he lost his virginity to a woman who looked exactly like her. That's something that's embarrassing, by the way. My casting people, everyone in the world knows that there is a kind of woman that Don, quote, likes, a type. And I did not know that. But I have cast, at this point, like 11 of them. And they're all different flavors of the same kind of woman. And Betty is not one of them. But all the other ones are very – these actresses are like a long line. Even Cara Bono, who is Dr. Faye, is a natural brunette. They all have a sort of – quality. I think I cast by voice, but you know, we'll get a Don Draper type. The casting, Carrie Audino said to me at one point at like season four, and I'm like, what does that mean? I'm casting all different kinds of actresses. I'm very proud of that fact that they're all different ages and, you know, different backgrounds, different ethnicities. You know, how could you say Bobby Barrett and, you know, and Suzanne the teacher are like the same type? And it turns out that they kind of are.
Do you feel any more?
Excuse me.
That's all right. Do you feel any more? Does it change the way you approach the show emotionally once the show becomes a hit and everyone knows about it and you're getting paid more and there seem to be more eyes on it? Do you feel like, oh, fuck, I really better focus? Or is it just like, are you pretty zen about that?
I've never absorbed it. I'm actually kind of absorbing it now that it's over.
Now that it's done.
Yeah, I share that with Dawn, I guess. I always felt pressure every episode and every season. Like, what am I going to do? I'm out of stuff. What is the next stage in this guy's life? And when I knew after we signed a contract that I would have 36 more episodes, it was freeing, but it was also kind of like, I'm always like, on my knees to the audience in some way. It may not seem that way. And I know that people think that, like, oh, you're like denying us this and it's a slow burn and you're playing with us. And I am always trying to please them in some way. I definitely felt the pressure from the beginning, even when no one was watching it. I really always felt like, I don't want to be embarrassed by it. I always sort of took everything down to the audience that I could really get a response from. I really care what my wife thought, what my writers thought, and what my actors thought. Mm-hmm. And that, like, I really didn't want to be, that's the pressure. It's like, we're coming back for season six. Yeah. Everybody's glad to be back to work, but like, are we going to, and is this the season where it's just going to like go to hell, or I'm like lost my mind, or, and the great thing is when you sort of commit to not repeating yourself, I would always sort of mentally say, like, you get asked by a reporter, like, you know, what are you gonna do next season? How are you gonna raise the bar or whatever? Right. And I was like, sort of, I don't think that way, probably because of terror. Instead of going up a notch, what you would perceive that, I will just go over here. I'm just going to a new place. It won't be measured by that. You know, maybe you don't like it as much as the story of the season before, but it's a totally different story, and I'm not being measured by anything except for this is the next phase in their life. And what's been interesting is to get closer to Don and to actually keep track of the progress, because we never forget what's happened. So you get at the end of season six, and Don, after being caught by his daughter, having an affair, I mean, it's a real low point. I was trying to tell the story of 1968, but Don had a bad year. Mm-hmm. He really, all these things we're talking about, it's his, like, his impulses, everything that we'd seen shades of was turned up a notch. And so he has this moment of reconciliation with his daughter, and you're like, has the guy changed? You know, is he getting older? Should I acknowledge that? You know, you take a risk. In season four, when Don got divorced, I kind of like had this big struggle. Like, am I going to say to the audience that he's an alcoholic? Half the fun of the show is seeing him drink with impunity and
right.
drive drunk and do all this and, you know, and like misbehave. And all of a sudden you're seeing Don drunker than ever.
Yeah.
And like sleeping with two women in the same night that he doesn't know their names, and stealing an idea, and sleeping with his secretary, and all these like really, really bad self-destructive behavior. And I was like, I hope I don't take the fun out of the show, but let's face it, the guy's got a drinking problem.
Well, and if you're following cause and effect, you know, I'm sure that happened to a lot. Well, it happens to people all the time, but I mean, particularly in that period where it was like, everyone do drugs, everything's right. fine, everyone fuck everyone,
right?
You know, that at a certain point, like, all those checks that they were writing, like, that's going to start to take a toll over the years, especially as you get older.
I mean, that's the thing is, are you going to acknowledge that the guy's moving on in his life? Has he learned anything?
Right.
And, you know, I'm only a little bit older than Don, and it's mostly because it took 7 years to get the show on the air. I was the same age as Don when I wrote the pilot. And I sort of look at it and I, you know, you hate to think of yourself as a statistic or something, but the passages of his life are pretty much the way it goes. And when he, right after he turned 4, I mean, everyone who had ever had a second marriage came up to me. anyone who had had a second marriage who came up to me would be like, oh my God, that was my second wife.
Oh, wow.
That was it. I just want to be with someone who saw me the way I wanted to be seen. And she's probably too young for me, and it didn't solve the problem, but, you know, I recognized her, and I recognized the idealism with which he went into that relationship. So you sort of start looking at the passages in your life, you know, when you get a certain point where, you know, you, all of a sudden your childhood is living with you all the time. You're like, why am I thinking about my childhood all the time? I'm not someone who dwells on that or lives with it. And then I put it to bed, but I used all that for Don, and so do the writers. You know, we have writers of all different ages on the show, which really helps, but I think that part of the fun of the show is because it's so many steps removed. It's period piece. It's third person. It's, you know, Don Draper ain't my doppelganger. You know what I mean? No one looks at us and thinks that's me. And I get to sort of, with all of these characters, sort of investigate all the things that are on my mind. It's been the gift of the show. I mean, that's where the show comes from, is whatever is on my mind gets to be in the show. I try to focus it into a story, and it it does have this subconscious thing where you're like, ah, oh, that's what that is.
Isn't that funny? Because we were just talking to Grant Morrison a couple days ago.
Oh, really?
Who's a really phenomenal, like he is an award-winning comic book writer.
I know who he is, believe it or not.
He said the exact same thing. He's like, well, when I'm writing Batman, if I'm dealing with like the death of my father, like that comes out. That comes out.
Absolutely.
And you really understand that the best writers tend to put humanity into the, like there's some piece of themselves, and that's how you kind of identify. I think it's that intangible thing that when you're watching it, I said this to him too, it's just like, if you're reading his stuff, like, oh, there's something that feels authentic, and I don't know why, but it just feels authentic, and it's because these are real things that are just being expressed.
This was the lesson of The Sopranos. You know, people don't know the timeline, but I wrote that pilot right around when The Sopranos went on the air. It got me my job on The Sopranos a good 2.5 years later. Then I wrote at The Sopranos for 4.5 years and was rewritten thoroughly the entire time, right, going through these characters and these stories. And then we made the pilot, and then I wrote the second episode. Okay? And in that time, I realized that things that were on my mind that, you know, executives frequently say are too specific – were the things that spoke the most to people.
Of course.
And they were specific to me. And I don't even think it's just good writers. I think it's any writer. I don't even know how you get anything done if you're not using your own thing. It's the, what do you have to say about it, you know? My wife is great at reading a script and I'm saying it's all about the feelings that you have when, you know, say something like Schadenfreude, which is this great German word when something good happens to another person
right.
and it makes you upset. And or something bad happens to another person.
Excited.
Excuse me. You get excited about it. And she says, yeah, but what are you saying about it? You can't just like present it to us. And that's the challenge. It's like, okay, so I've got this environment where I can recreate it, you know? We did an entire season that was all about success. And we just did this half season, the first half of the season where and money's big on the show, which isn't big on a lot of entertainment, but you know, it's a big part of our lives, you know, what we need, what we don't need, material objects, whatever. But we just did this season that was about Don like sucking it up and working his way up in his own company, working his way back up in his own company. And the entire and you know, making things right with Peggy and making things right with his daughter to some degree and kind of doing the right thing in a less selfish, more sober way. The whole tension of the season, the thing that is keeping you on your edge of your seat is you just can't believe it's going to work out. You just think, when's he going to fuck it up? What's his secret plan? When's he going to just like, you know, whip it out and start killing people, you
right.
know? And that to me is like, you know, exploring those tiny things, you know. We did an episode called Maiden Form, which was in the second season that was all about how other people see you and the sort of like, which you can capture on film, you know, because you can do POV shots
sure.
and things like that. And there was this people playing with their own image, and it ended with Don looking in the mirror and just like, and his daughter talking to him and him not even be able to look, literally not look himself in the mirror because he's so such a liar.
Right.
And you know, that's like a small private moment. I don't think that doesn't sound so action-packed, but, you know, the show has been a gift to be able to explore things like that. And it's, like I said, it's not for everybody, but I'm proud of the fact that it has, without any contrivance or effort, maintained its weirdness, because that's what we all wanted to do, you know? And the actors have always on board with it. They love it. They love the tension of waiting for the phone to ring, you know?
Well, because everyone's character everyone's character has a lot of dimension because they're all, you know, to some degree, they're sort of playing off that the idea that was contemporary for the time of, and to some degree today too, although people love to share everything about everything now. But
yeah.
But the idea.
But then you also wonder what's underneath it.
Exactly. And it's exploring all of the, here's who they are to each other publicly in this environment that they're in, and then they go home, and then
I see this on Facebook where people write things that are so personal, and I'm thinking like, okay, you're writing it, you're broadcasting it. What's what's underneath that? What's the weird shit that's underneath that?
Oh, right. Yeah, because, you know, there is this, you know, there is this idea now that I think where we have to, people need to be validated. I mean, it's all about validation. And so they'll give you a little bit of something that will, you know, you'll get attention or validation in some way. And I think that if they get that small piece of validation for whatever that nugget is, it somehow retroactively validates all the other bullshit underneath. They're like, oh, I'll just get this one piece validated and that'll take care of me for everything else.
And this goes back to the superiority thing, because you have to really admit that you're in that validation state, which is really embarrassing.
It is.
And I think that so much of, like, just let's take a concept like loneliness, which a lot of my work at this point has in it. It's something that I not only that I experience, I'm not saying that it's like a lack of gratitude. I have four wonderful children. I have a wonderful wife, but it is part of the human experience. There are people who don't want to acknowledge its existence because it's too much for them.
Sure.
And they, you know, like Don, may start drinking to not feel that horrible feeling. I am always kind of curious because I approach the show like, well, you know, we all feel this. And sometimes people are like, I don't. And you're like, really? Maybe they don't. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know.
Well, I mean, it almost doesn't matter if everyone feels that way. Yeah. As long as it's an authentic feeling that you have, I guess that's like, all that matters. But
right, you never think that your mom is nicer to your sister than you? And they're like, no, we all get along. And I'm like, well, you must be the favorite. And they're like, no, my mom doesn't have any favorites. And I was like, I think I can't even really have this conversation with you because I can't, then there's nothing to write about.
Well, also, I think there's something about your show that even in the opening credit sequence where it's a, particularly for that time where all of a sudden, you know, television and ads and like just the nature of the business that they work in, that people are being, and it's way worse today, but people's brains are being constantly inundated with image and data and things that they have to process over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. And everyone...
And it's all idealized.
It's all idealized. That's so everyone has an identity crisis. Like everyone has a weird identity crisis versus, oh, these ads are an idealized version of who I should be.
Here's the weird thing.
Those people,
here's
the
weird thing that you bring this up, because this period right now, and I just noticed this, is the most like the 50s in that. It is so, you cannot look at advertising and not feel bad about yourself. And it's not always a good strategy for every image to be a perfect person for you to, like, you know, have to read about, like, how you, if you're a woman, like you don't have a gap between your thighs or whatever it is. That's not always a great sales technique. And part of what happened in the late 60s in the quote unquote creative revolution is that there was a more subversive element to advertising, and a lot of it wasn't idealized, and were more real people on TV, and sometimes to the point of grotesques, and Where's the Beef is probably the end of it, but the beginning of it is like, that's a spicy meatball. You start seeing ethnic people, you start seeing like a Jewish sense of humor, you start seeing these things that had completely not been part of it. And we talked about this on the show, that dad with the pipe and the convertible that we laugh at, the Leave It to Beaver family, we are constantly being inundated with that image right now.
Of course.
And it's I don't know if the people understand that the photoshopped, you know, super sexualized mom, dad, you know, the fitness, the idealized family, even if it's multicultural, it is all so far from the reality that we live in, that we live in this state of kind of self-hatred.
Well,
it's not a great way to sell shit.
No.
It's not the best way.
The other dark side of it
I must be wrong because they keep doing it.
But the other dark side of it is companies knowing that people are scared and insecure and anxious and depressed and basically in a passive aggressive way, like creating a problem that doesn't really exist and going, here's the problem, but we have the cure for this problem.
That's salesmanship.
Yeah.
I don't want to say no to that, but I'm not going to criticize that. I actually think that's okay. I think if you're smart enough to create a problem and have the solution,
then it's okay.
You're probably either a manager in the entertainment business or you are a good salesperson. What bothers me is the idea of there's a sales pitch that I've tried to say that Don is above. It's kind of what the pilot's about, which is you're a piece of crap. And I used to feel that way. But I have this product.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to this product makes me feel like the person I want to be.
Right.
And both of those are good sales techniques. And Don is aspirational, and most of the other stuff is negative. We talk about it, you know, with like there's a deodorant strategy that is like, I feel confident, I feel strong, I feel clean. That's what our product is uniquely suited for, is to make you feel confident. And there's the other one is like, God, I smell horrible. People smell horrible. What am I going to do about it? And those two things, I mean, it's you know, the funny thing is the advertising business was really in a crisis when we started the show, just cyclically. You know, just business-wise, the internet had come along. They didn't know what to do with it. You know, then the TiVo comes along. They don't even know what to do. How are they going to reach people? And they have rebounded in a way. And it has to do with our tolerance for it also. But they have rebounded in a way where we have a higher tolerance for advertising than ever before. And yes, we used to read the newspaper and there'd be ads sandwiched in between them. But now they go right on top of it. And no one has said, I won't read this,
right,
or I won't buy this. No one has said anything about it. You're seeing more advertising I'm not a statistician, but you are seeing more advertising by the day than ever in the history of human behavior. And it's a lot of noise and a lot of people selling something. And I think a lot of it cancels itself out and it becomes an incredible irritant, which is part of the strategy on some level. But, getting your message embedded in some way that is palatable to people, it's like harder and harder and harder to do. So there's just like this technological bombardment, you know, look, I mean, just the sides of our buildings. It hasn't been like that since like the 30s.
Well, people expect it.
I think that they kind of like it. I think they like the noise and the color and the activity.
The distraction.
I think it's stimulating. It was interesting to see a movie like Her and see this future world where there were all these screens and everything, and it was deeply absent of advertising. And it kind of like made it a little lonelier, mm-hmm. actually. When you look at it, I mean, not that Blade Runner is like the future you want to live in, but like that's where we are right now.
Right.
Every 8 billion screens, you know, constantly you get in the back of a taxi in New York and you're like, how do I turn this thing off? Oh no, I actually turned it on.
I can't stop it. I just need someone to distract me from my brain.
Exactly.
But I think one of the most beautifully simple things about the show is that the very thing that makes Don amazing at his job is actually his biggest character flaw, which is his ability to create an idealized version of something out of something that is shitty.
I think that he won't actually make a shitty product shitty. That's not what he's trying to do, but I think that I was always interested in the creative process, and I don't even know if this really works in advertising or if it's just in our fictitious advertising world, because it's rigged. I mean, I write the clients and I write whether the campaign's success. My whole thing was always like, with the writers, like, let's write a pitch that even if you don't know advertising is going to persuade you. Who knows if it's really going to work?
Right.
And really, he just has to persuade the clients. And what I always liked was that he would take his personal life and use that as the problem. And that his research is kind of emotional because he's an outsider. And his flaw of like not having a past or not having a codified background allows him to sort of filter it into something else. And a lot of times the most negative qualities end up in these. But in the end, I think because he wants to be something else, he's always making the products part of one.
Yeah,
because
he's basically a walking advertisement.
Yeah.
He's a walking advertisement for the person that he wants to be.
The guy who sells him the Cadillac, you know. When we had a freelance writer come in, and I had one of these like magic moments on the way to work where an entire scene came to me, and I walked in and I like dictated it right away, and my assistant wrote it down, and then I like rewrote it, I typed it up, and I just handed it to the person who was writing the draft, and I'm like, put this in. This is Don selling the Cadillac, the Cadillac salesman. And the guy says to him, he's got this cheesy sales pitch. He's like, what do you, you know, I don't have to explain this to you. You're walking about in a Cadillac every day. Look at you. And they're like, that's so gross. I'm like, Don loves this. He appreciates it. Nothing works better than to tell somebody that you are going to be the thing you always wanted to be if you use this product.
Right.
And, you know, I have to say almost all of his sales pitches come back down to that, where he's like, It's where he's sort of saying like, well, who do you want to be? And he knows who he wants to be.
There's one specific line in the show that always stuck with me. And when I saw it, and it was years ago when I saw it, I think I was alone, and I even said out loud, "Oh fuck," which is because there's just something so powerful about this. It was right after Peggy has the baby,
right,
and she's in the hospital, and Don basically says something to her like, it will shock you,
yeah,
how quickly you will get over this, or how much you'll forget." I can't remember what the exact
how much you forget it,
how much you will forget this, and I don't know why it just it never occurred to me before, and then you. And then you see so much about him, and then he's basically mentoring her in this weird, fucked up...
Right, and it's not a great strategy for life, but it is a survivor strategy.
It is, but
it is
that
a survivor strategy.
That idea is so freaky. Like, it will shock you, and you're like, oh my... Because then you just start to go, oh my God, what am I capable of?
Well, you know what? You every once in a while, someone will come up to you, especially if you're a famous person. I'm sure that you've seen people that you haven't seen for years, and they come up and tell you a story about yourself. And you are just overwhelmed with embarrassment. Has this ever happened to you?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And you're like, that wasn't me. Like and you have blocked that out because you couldn't survive. I mean, we've all done terrible things. I mean, that's the show's based on the fact that I believe that.
Right.
So, if you're above it, good for you. But I happen to believe that if nothing else, things, even if they're not that terrible, that we feel terrible about. And you do block them out. The funny thing is at the time I thought, he is doing her a favor. He is giving her a gift to get over this thing and move on. But it is a terrible strategy for life.
Right.
Because it never goes away. It doesn't go away. And we can see that. You know, we're now 80 episodes from that episode. And you can see, you forget it, but it rears itself up all over the place.
Shit doesn't stay in Vegas. It comes home with you.
Exactly. That's totally fantastic. No one's ever put it that way. That's absolutely true.
It doesn't stay in Vegas. Yeah. It may get home a little slower.
I kept saying to people, like, we'd write these scenes, like, whenever Peggy still, and I've had this confirmed from people who've gone through it, but it gets duller and duller. Anyone who's lost a loved one or whatever, it gets duller and duller. But it's like, Peggy sees a child. It's never nothing to her.
Of course.
It's never. She went through that pregnancy in denial, delivered that baby, put it up for adoption, had a psychotic break, basically, and then got back into life. It never went away. And she's gotten older, and maybe we're starting to see, you have to watch the rest of the show and see what else there is for her. But I didn't realize it as much. I mean, that's embarrassing, too. I just thought, God, he's doing her a huge favor. Because I admire survivors. I really do. I probably have my own survival skills, and a lot of it has to do with denial and forgetting and escaping into entertainment and
sure.
writing and making up my own version of things like a writer does. But, when we did the Kennedy assassination, there was this moment in the room where everybody knew, like, Don's going to go to work. I mean, his wife left him. Like, after the assassination, his wife basically said, "I don't love you anymore." And he went into work, and Peggy was there too. And we're like, these guys are survivors. He can comfort other people, but he's going to wake up tomorrow and just like put it out of his mind.
He is, but all that stuff,
No, I know.
Like whenever you go through a tragedy or whenever you go through any kind of a law and you can mash it down for the time being, but sooner or later, it starts to bubble up in other ways. And you may not even realize that the two are connected, and then at a certain and then at some point,
but there are people.
You think there?
I know there are.
Well, those people are sociopaths.
A lot of them are in very great positions of power. They because, really are
because they're able to divorce themselves from.
I
the emotional
think
components.
We, I think we depend on them to. They have this study about like putting people in the army, and like there's like 50% of the population. It's like huge. Will crack up under combat situations. And then there's like 15%, another like, let's say 25% that will have trouble, but will do as told and might have scars afterwards. And then there's like something like, it goes all the way down to like 10% of the population that will do it and probably should only be in the military because they really have no problem with it at all. And you look at the war, it's part of the story of the show, drafting regular people and putting regular people in that situation of having their life threatened and being away from home and being under fire and being forced to
all of
kill,
a sudden.
Yeah, and then you like take them home afterwards, and they all shared it as a culture. But PTSD, it wasn't even a concept. They like developed that term very, very late in the game. It's like it's a while after World War II. So I do believe, and maybe it is. Look, you talk to a surgeon. I'm not a surgeon. I don't know how you could deal with having somebody's life in your hand all the time.
All the time, yeah.
I don't think
and
I could
losing
cut,
lives.
And losing lives. And I don't think I could cut someone up with a knife. We talked about this with Arnold, and Don sort of asks him about it, and he's like, I don't think about it. I don't have – that's why people pay me. I don't want to say it, but I don't think about it. Of course, I don't want to lose them, and it's horrible, and you want to beat it, and you want to win, and you want to use your skill, and you want to cure, and you want to heal. But I can't have that on my mind all the time, or I couldn't operate.
Well, I mean, your brain is essentially a closed circuit. So it – you know, I think there's a conservation of emotional energy where it's the energy it can't be destroyed. It can transmute into other things that you maybe don't connect to that. But I don't. But I think it
may come out somewhere else. All I know is that you can get up and perform in front of 30,000 people in a sports stadium, and for most people, they would have a heart attack and die. And you know, that's why we, you know,
it's because I have a desperate need for attention, Matt. Like I
do too. Lots of people love attention. Go on Facebook. They don't. They're taking the chicken's way out.
Yeah.
And you know, I remember meeting someone because I did stand up in college, and I mean, I was physically like not capable of doing it. I would sort of survive it every time. And I imagine you can get used to it, but like I bombed once and then I was like, how am I ever going to do this again? And I met a guy who had no problems with it. He was not that funny. That was not his skill. And in fact, he eventually got people to write jokes for him like an old fashioned comedian, and he did great. And I will not say who it is, but his skill was that he was not afraid of that.
Mm-hmm.
He was energized and focused by it. And I thought, like, what a gift, you know? I'm energized and focused by deadlines, you know?
Yeah.
Different. And taking us back to sociopaths, I do think that there are people who can really put stuff out of their mind. I'm not saying it doesn't go anywhere. I'm not saying that they don't have a psychic scar, but you know what? It's funny. It was a great comfort to me. I was reading a book, this hilarious book about the SS, and they were saying
some light reading.
And I was on vacation. You know, you're in Hawaii, you want to read about the SS.
Sure.
And they were talking about the amount of booze that they gave these guys. And I was totally comforted by the fact that they had to be drunk.
Oh, that it wasn't just
that it wasn't just like right. A bunch of people who could shoot a baby.
That were that inhumane.
Shoot a baby, yeah. And they're like, they don't see them as people. There's all kinds of rationalizations for how you get people to do it. War atrocities group. This is what it was about. Sort of like how do you get a group to do this? Are they naturally bad or what? You know, they're different than you and me in some way. Would you behave that way? This is one of the big mysteries. Like, could you turn anybody into one of these guys? And you can't. But when I saw how much booze that they gave them, it was a comfort to me that they needed to drink and needed to not – that they knew that that was what they were doing. It was a bad feeling that they wanted to get rid of.
Right. Do you feel now that we're now that the show's done, the last handful of episodes are next year? Right?
Yes.
So
and I'm still editing it.
You're
so
still editing.
Pretty done. But I am starting to talk about it in the past tense. It's interesting.
Well, that
it just happened like a couple of weeks ago.
Do you feel well? Then you haven't even really processed it yet, I would imagine.
I suppose that I will truly process it when the last episode airs.
Mm-hmm.
But the ending production and seeing everybody sort of whittle away has been a massive, massive change. I don't know if I'll ever process it. I mean, one of the great things about making this movie is that I got to go out and do it and do something different and do a script that I cared about as much as Mad Men and finally get it done. And that it was like an escape hatch and you sort of start thinking about the future and what else you're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, like I wrote the pilot 14 years ago.
Jesus.
It's a third of my, it took seven. This is anybody out there who is aspiring writer. It has a happy ending. But here's the story.
You can be patient.
Yeah. Yeah. 7 years between writing the pilot and it going on the air.
Mm-hmm.
And now I've been on the air for 7 years.
So 14 years of your
14
life.
It's a third of my life.
Yeah.
A little bit less.
So you better like the shit you're writing because the best
yeah.
case scenario is you're stuck with it.
Well, that's the thing too, is that people tell you, you know, people, you know this, you have this, you're so busy and you've hands in so many places and you're developing all this, people are like enjoying yourself and you're kind of like feel guilty about how much work you're doing and how much you're complaining and how tired you are and how busy you are and how much stress you have. But you are, that's the part that I've processed. I will never get over just from the change from being, even working on The Sopranos, from being a struggling writer who, here's some things that writers will identify with. I would finish a script and people had to read it within 7 hours of me turning it in because I would finish it around 2 a.m. and I would come in at 2 and I would expect notes. So people are reading your work right away. And anybody who's been working on scripts at home knows you give it to people and who knows if, I mean, I personally have like neglected to read so many people's, that's now that I'm done, I got to read everybody's stuff. But just getting it read instantly. And then the things that I was writing after the pilot and a couple of episodes into the series, I didn't have to sell those scripts anymore. They were going to get shot. They mm-hmm. had to because the train is running. And as terrifying as it is that I need another script in 8 days, everything that I was writing got shot.
Mm-hmm.
And you learn so much, like two people in a room working with different directors, like how many times are you going to do this scene? You got to make it different. Every single time you can make it different if you really try. What can you do to make it? Why does it feel familiar? Don't do it again. And the luxury of being a writer in show business and writing scenes and knowing that everything's going to get shot, it's so spoiled. And then to have an audience, that's the other thing, that people are going to watch it. It doesn't really matter how many of them there are. You literally don't know if you're ever going to be heard.
Sure.
So all of that, which, you know, forget about like working with a great cast and being surrounded by talented writers and hiring people who've never done anything and seeing them become great, you know, writers, directors, whatever. That's like, I mean, that's the part that strokes your ego is like,
of course,
you know,
I was right.
Like, I found him. I found her. Right. You know, I have two people on my writing staff I taught one semester at USC. They were both students and like, you know, they're both great writers and they kind of were when I met them, which no one needs to know, but they, it's why I hired them. But to see their careers happening, to see first time directors getting, you know, awards and things like that. And also working with like people who are deep into their careers or, you know, it's just the creative satisfaction of taking this unit of like sometimes 700 people are involved in making the show in a season, forgetting about how many background and all the actors and everything that we hire and turning it into this product and kind of like being in every, and you know me, I mean, I'm notorious for this, but I'm kind of involved in every phase. I don't do everything, but I'm a witness to everything. I see everything that gets done. I check up on it. It's, that's the part I processed is, you know, it's gone from the feeling, and I think I talked to Vince Gilligan about this, but I was saying that the transition that I've made is the feeling from feeling like I've lost something to feeling like I made something.
Yes.
And that is like almost like I'm almost too superstitious to say something like that. Does that sound egotistical or
no,
whatever
not
it
at
is?
All.
But
I mean, you should
it is
be
psychologically
proud of it.
Very helpful. Well, I've always been proud of it, but it's kind of like it's like it and I were not together. And to like, you know, 7 years is longer than college for most people.
Yeah.
You know, to have the same job for 7 years in show business is very unusual.
Oh yeah.
And then, you know, one day you turn off the lights and we're all going to see each other again, but we'll never be together in that thing. That was pretty emotional.
Yeah. And especially, you know, when you have, cause I've had a lot of jobs in the past and when you're in it, you're like, oh, this is going to last for a while. And then all of a sudden it's over and you're like, where did those several years go? It's like, it's just over.
I have people, you know, the characters have aged as much as the actors. You know, we've gone a few more years on the show than in real life, but, you know, marriages, divorces, children being born, you know, homes being bought, you know, people winning awards, people trying new professions, people, you know, just like all the stuff happening within the sphere of this experience. And I don't know. I'm saying it all out loud. I'm like, oh my God, I'm jinxing it. But it's
no,
it's,
you can't.
Now
well,
I
don't.
Now I can't because it's over.
Yeah, and you don't have the power.
They can't
to jinx
take
it.
That away.
You,
oh,
you,
I do.
You don't.
I do.
You think
don't know.
So?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
No.
Well, are you happy? Just as we're sort of wrapping up, are you
sure.
Are you happy with? Do you feel? I mean, obviously, I would assume that you would be happy with the show, but do you feel a sense of completeness where it lands in the end, even though we don't know what that is yet?
I think you can tell from talking to me that I'm like, you know, I reached a point. I told you I want the audience to love it. It is no matter what, I did exactly what I wanted to do.
Good.
So we have no idea how that will be perceived or what it'll mean to people or. You know, I took it exactly where I wanted to go. And that immediate group, unless they're lying to me, of my real, you know, my wife and that family, my writing room and that family, and the actors, you know, the crew, all the people, everyone seemed to be, thought that it was the way to do it, you know. Who knows? You know, that is the weirdest thing about episodic television is ending things is not part of their skill set. It's the newest part of it. It really is. By nature, episodic TV does not resolve.
Right.
You can kill characters and so forth, but it's got to come back the next week. It's got to propel itself. Even the season finale has to propel you into the next season. So here you are, and this is where you're leaving them. And that was that's a life moment.
Well, that's the best you can. I think that's the best you can do is just make the thing that you are happy with, and then your circle is happy with. Because if you are every season, like you said earlier, like we got to raise the bar, then you're chasing audience expectations, and then that's too.
And the story can get out of control.
It's too result oriented as opposed to. I think people.
I don't think you can sustain it.
No,
I think it's just like it becomes a different. It becomes like
because you can only go so
exactly.
So that's why it's more important. I would say to be process oriented than goal or than result. Oriented.
It'd be a dream to be like that. I'm not saying I'm not result oriented. I would like to talk that way as if I were evolved, but I did feel like I had this ending for so long that it was one of the things on the show that I didn't try and run away from.
Yeah.
And what I'm wondering is if it airs and it bombs, if everyone's going to come out and say like, I never liked it. I didn't want to tell you were so into
it. You can't control that. You just have to stick to what you feel good about.
I've been good about that. I'm extremely susceptible to other people's opinions, but for some reason or other, I always still end up doing what I want to do.
That's good.
It's stubbornness or something. I don't know.
Well, if you didn't have that, you wouldn't be here.
That is true. It is a good skill.
So lastly, do you want to say anything about the movie before we...
Yeah, it's called Are You Here? It opens on August 22nd. It has Owen Wilson, Zach Galifianakis, and Amy Poehler in it. And it's very different than Mad Men. My intention was kind of to write about things that were on my mind that are not in the show, obviously, and to sort of make a bit of a throwback, a bit of a 70s movie. I love Five Easy Pieces. I love The Last Detail. I love these films. And to do a sort of a little bit grimier, a little less glamorous version of a story about what holds people together.
Mm-hmm.
Zach and Owen play best friends. You don't really know how that they are friends. And one of them needs to get on drugs and the other one needs to get off them. And it has a lot of humor in it. And obviously they're really funny guys, but the sort of, maybe it's my own like defectiveness in genre. The story is really told to recreate real life. And like those films did during that period. And you hopefully will get a sense it has a real plot, it has a real story, but you will get a sense of these guys think that they're living in a movie. They think they're two stoner buddies. And then as the story goes on, you realize like, oh no, wait a minute. He has a drug problem and he's fucking crazy. And Amy is fantastic. I mean, it's a dream actually, you know, to work with people that funny and to see them. I think comedians a lot of times are more capable of giving emotion. Because it kind of comes out at the last moment. It can be maudlin sometimes, but I recognize them as people. In fact, everyone I cast on Mad Men is pretty funny.
Oh yeah.
And I think people know that now, but they play kind of serious, but they all know when they're making jokes. And there was something great about seeing Owen and Zach together playing these extremes. And Owen is like guileless. He's easygoing. He's like likable. He's irresponsible, but he is taking care of his friend, Zach, who is you know, a blowhard and a grows his own weed and is like got this philosophy about like, you know, anti-technology, anti-society. And you start to realize like, well, Owen's character is taking care of him. But when Zach inherits all this money, you basically have a new problem because his sister doesn't know why the family fuck up is getting all the money. And the two of them together, Owen and Zach together, are going to figure out what to do with the money. And Zach's ideas are not exactly rooted in reality. So for me, it was a way to talk about a lot of things that are going on right now and to sort of talk about the ugliness of the world that we're talking about right now, to talk about all of the alienating factors in modern society and how amazing it is to actually have someone. The first line that I had in the movie that I sort of built the movie around is Owen sort of is questioned about his friendship with Zach and why he's friends with him. And he says, that's the thing about friendship is that you see it on TV. No one eats alone. People go with each other to the doctor, but most people are alone. And the thing about friendship is it's rarer than love because there's nothing in it for anybody. Oh, and nice. I kind of wanted to build my way to that. And I think you see it in the movie. And there's a lot of emotion. And it's pretty funny. You know, I never it's my sense of humor, so I like it. they really play real people and the characters kind of switch places over the course of the story, which is great. And Amy, you know, you work with someone like that. We talked about at a certain point, you know, she is such a finely tuned. First of all, she loved playing Zach's sister because they kind of are. When you see them next to each other, they could be brother and sister. Right. And they're kind of like they have a. And she's the adult in the movie. She's kind of the killjoy. But everyone, like most of the things I write, everybody has a reason for doing what they do. But we had a conversation at a certain point where, like, how far do you want to turn up the funny? Like, you can make this so it's not real.
Right.
If you want to. And she just found a way to keep her in the real zone. And, you know, she's a very fine actress. I think you see it in the movie. So,
Are You Here, August 22nd.
Yes.
And then Mad Men comes back next year, or in the spring, I would assume?
It's a top secret. Yeah, but it's I'm pretty sure it's April.
Okay.
it's top secret for me. I'm guessing.
Sometime around there.
At a certain point, I'm going to say it's April enough where they're going to be like, stop telling people it's April, it's May. I'm like, well, you can let me know.
Okay, fine. It's April. But it's really good to see you. And,
it's good to see you, too. I always enjoy talking to you. And yes. It's so flattering, the things you say about the show.
The show, I fucking love the show. And I'm excited but sad at the same time because it's night. You know, when you have a show, like you form a relationship with a show, you're like, that show's always there. And then you're like, it's not there anymore.
I feel that way about it, you know, about other shows. I think, you know, maybe I'll come back and talk to you when it's over and you will see what emotions were in our life that we put in the show.
Yeah.
Because when you ask me that question, all I'm thinking about is these episodes that no one's seen, and that's what it is. It's like I used every
It's your emotional diary at the same time.
Yeah, and that's pathetic.
No, it's good. You'll always have that.
I have such a low tolerance for alcohol, but I'm an incredible enabler.
Thanks, Matt.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Thank you.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.